Now, with those very quick technical reminders, I think we're ready to get started. So I'm going to call up Sam Siegel from EPA's Office of Brownfield and Land Revitalization to turn on his camera. And as he's doing that, I'm going to swap out the view here, call up the presentation content, and it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to Sam to begin today's presentation.
Great. Can you hear and see me all right?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our webinar on affordable and workforce housing development on former brownfield sites. Thank you, Jean, for hosting this webinar, and thank you to everyone for joining today. Our registration data showed registrants from over 40 states, which was great to see, and also shows the significance of the issues that we will go over today across the entire country. My name is Sam Siegel. I've been working at the EPA in the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalizations for nearly 4 years now. We have Amy Storm joining us from OBLR as well. She knows everything about our program and will be on for Q&A at the end. And just to provide a little bit more background on the Brownfields program, we provide grants and technical assistance to communities, states, and tribes to assess, clean up, and safely reuse contaminated properties. We have an annual grant cycle for our main grant types, which are assessment, cleanup, multipurpose, and revolving loan fund. 2024 awards are scheduled to be announced in May, and 2025 grant opportunities will be open for applications in the fall of 2024. If you aren't familiar with our program and your community has brownfields challenges, please reach out to me or your regional EPA office. We have many free resources available to get you started. Joining us today are two experts on all things brownfields, redevelopment, and housing from our technical assistance providers, ADAPTA. Tom and Mary have worked with dozens of communities across the country, providing free support for these communities to develop plans to safely reuse their brownfield sites. Tom and Mary, could you please say hello and give a brief introduction?
Good morning, everybody. This is Mary Hashem. I am the founder and president of ADAPTA. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today.
Tom, sadly, we are missing out on these gems. There we go.
Good morning, everyone. Sorry about that. My name's Tom Correll. I'm also a member of the team at ADAPTA, and I have over 25 years of experience working on affordable housing development projects around the country. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Great. Thank you, Mary and Tom. So we have some goals for this webinar. More so topics, but I think the goal is to effectively build understanding on the following topics. We will discuss the shortage of affordable housing at the national level and the challenges of building more housing. We will look into the advantages and disadvantages of developing housing on brownfield sites. We will discuss the role of public agencies and nonprofit developers. We will think about addressing funding gaps, and we will highlight available funding resources. So I'm going to start this webinar off with a brief SWOT analysis on housing on former brownfield sites. I know it's 2024. SWOTs may be seen as old school or overly formulaic, but we thought it was important to show housing isn't always the answer, and we are not endorsing building affordable housing on every brownfield site. Housing can be one of the most beneficial reuses, but it is also one of the most challenging. And I'm just going to go through everything on these next four slides at a high level. A lot of it will be expanded on later by Tom and Mary. So it's pretty intuitive why affordable and workforce housing on former brownfields is great. You're reusing a former community hazard to give more places for people to live, which will improve the local economy and increase tax revenues. Particularly when these projects incorporate urban infill, there's also a big impact on human health and the environment. Just to name a few, brownfields redevelopment reduces vehicle miles traveled and related emissions by around 50%, reduces storm water runoff by an estimated 50%, accelerates the use of green building codes and renewable energy. And then obviously there's the removal of contaminants and pollutants, which improves air quality, water quality, and natural habitats. On the other side, future housing has some of the most stringent cleanup requirements. You may have to use a more costly and time-intensive cleanup method to prepare a contaminated site for housing compared to a commercial or industrial use. And then once the site is cleaned up, you also have to consider the cost to develop the housing. This reuse is a lot more costly than low-intensity reuses like green space or open space. Which brings me to opportunities. There are grant programs, tax credits, and private developers out there that will make site reuse vision financially feasible. Tom will cover this in much more detail later on. But our data indicates that on average, over $21 is leveraged for each federal brownfield dollar spent. This means that a $500,000 cleanup grant on average reports over $10 million in leveraged funding. And while there are some big outliers influencing these numbers, we do really see brownfields grants as seed funding to start larger redevelopment efforts. And then affordable and workforce housing will also lead to more diverse economy and workforce, which will provide new opportunities to your community. And there are threats to these types of projects too. Although there is a huge demand for housing nationwide, some communities without migration may not need to build additional housing. And then if your brownfield site is miles outside of any downtown area or economic hub, there might not be demand for workforce or affordable housing at that specific site. And another important consideration is community support. Some communities don't want the affordable housing to go on formerly contaminated sites for perceived health reasons and messaging reasons. And there are also many other reasons why a community may or may not support housing on any particular brownfield site. So engaging your community is an important first step in the planning process. And zoning regulations may impact the options you have available to you as well. And with that, we'll call back up Jean and Mary to go over the first participant poll question.
All right. So, Mary, I've got you on the spotlight there, and I'm about to join you because we have a question, don't we?
Yes, we do. And so Sam has gone through the SWOT analysis on putting brownfields to use as housing. So my question here is a very overarching one. Have you or your community ever considered a brownfield site as a possibility for creating more housing in your community? Simple yes/no answer. We would appreciate you clicking the button and weighing in to answer. We'll have this open for just a minute, and then we will give you the results and talk about it just a little bit.
All
Can
right, thank you,
everybody
Mary.
see
Yeah,
the
so we have
poll?
a, yeah, there's a poll floating on the screen for most of you. If you happen to be on a mobile device, you might need to hit the three dots more or even a poll icon depending on your device to open it. If for any reason you can't see that floating window, you can always type your response in the Q&A just like Karen did. You can share your answer there. But it is a simple yes or no. You click that circle and then hit the submit button. It looks like about three quarters of the audience, so about 150 of you, have shared your responses in that poll. And I don't see anything else coming in. So I'm going to go ahead and close the poll down here in 3, 2, 1. And Mary, it does look like almost 90% of the audience said yes to that question, that they have considered a brownfield site.
This is terrific. It's really good to hear because brownfields are often ideal locations for housing. Because they are often infill sites, they already have utilities and infrastructure to them. Often transit and accessibility are there at a brownfield site. And so these can, cleaned up properly and handled properly, make great sites for brownfield for housing redevelopment. And to give you a few examples of that, I'm going to invite Tom to come back and talk to you about a couple of case studies of housing development on brownfields. Tom?
Thanks, Mary. Let's go to that next slide. So this is our first case study example, and you'll see in the slide deck, there's a link here to places where you can find additional information about these case studies. This is the first one we'll look at. We'll look at some others as we go through the presentation. We selected this case in particular because it is the adaptive reuse of a historic structure that was an old cotton mill in Georgia. This was converted into 71 loft-style apartments, one, two, and three bedrooms, and it also made use of the historic tax credit preservation program, which helped fund this. The tax credits that were awarded to this project raised over $9 million in equity, and the cleanup of this site addressed significant impacts to soil on this site from the almost 100-year operation of this facility as an old cotton mill. EPA provided an assessment grant to this, and there was also the state of Georgia providing a response program grant to help bring this development to fruition. So this gives you one example of where you could reuse an existing facility to deliver housing in your community. And this particular development included a number of great amenities in addition to the affordability that it offered for the residents there. So Mary, I'll hand it back to you to talk a little bit more about site assessment and all appropriate inquiry.
Right. Just briefly. Thank you, Tom. Remember, we are not going to go through due diligence and all appropriate inquiry in phase ones on this webinar today. But be aware, if your community is considering purchasing a brownfield site, acquiring it in any way for any kind of development, housing or otherwise, you want to make sure that you're going through all appropriate inquiry. These are the steps outlined by the federal government, by EPA, so that you get the benefit of liability protections, but also so that you can have access to brownfield grant funding and all of the brownfields program support. These technical assistance and funds are available only to innocent purchasers and people who have gone through the all appropriate inquiry process. If you have any questions about this, reach out to your regional EPA representatives, your brownfield leads at the region, to your state brownfields offices, to the technical assistance providers in your region. There are lots of resources out there to help make sure that you check these boxes before you buy a site. With that, Tom?
Great. Thanks, Mary. So one of the next things we wanted to turn our attention to is just kind of level setting definitions of affordable housing, because they're used in different ways. And from HUD's perspective, they talk about affordable housing as a descriptor that is any housing that doesn't require more than 30% of a household's income. Within the community development and real estate development industry, when the term affordable housing is used, it's often referring to a particular type of funding and financing structure that's utilized to deliver housing at a lower than market rate rent or sale price, depending on the type of housing. That means it may be using the federal low-income housing tax credit program or any one of the number of other housing development programs that we're going to talk about later in today's presentation. Those programs are characterized by the level of incomes of tenants, which they're designed to serve. So when we talk about affordable housing, we're typically talking about housing that's serving households at or below 60% of the area median's income. By contrast, the HUD programs that are out there typically have an income restriction of 80% of the area median income. So those programs can serve a little broader range of residents' needs. Then workforce housing, or that missing middle housing, generally describes housing that's been developed to serve the needs of households that are above that 60% tax credit program limit, up to about 120%. That exact number varies from community to community and market to market, and has a lot to do with the relationship between construction and land costs in a given area and where wages are at in that area. But as is often touted, you can have folks that are working as teachers in the school system, working as first responders or as public safety, kind of the core supports in our communities, and those individuals are not making enough money to be able to afford housing in their community. And in many instances, they're making more money than would allow them to be eligible for some of the housing financed through these programs. So workforce housing is serving that missing middle, and this gives you kind of an overview of where those income levels are. We thought it would be important today as well to just touch on the magnitude of the housing gap in our country today. And this is something, fortunately, that's gotten a lot of attention, and I think is evidenced by the number of participants that we have in today's webinar of just what a big challenge this is. These are some statistics from the National Low Income Housing Coalition that address this, but even for the most for the lowest income individuals in our communities, the national estimation is that we're missing close to 7 million housing units today. In addition to that, we have over a half a million people on any given night who have no place to live, not even space in a shelter. And the impacts at the bottom end of our income levels, the lowest income individuals in our society have the heaviest housing burden. That is, a vast majority of them are paying well more than half of their income just to afford housing, and that leaves them very little financial safety net. And of the programs that are out there today, those programs are only serving about one in four very low income families. It's a complicated issue, this issue of delivering affordable housing and meeting the gaps that are out there. And we wanted to present the category of those challenges kind of divided up into three different areas. The inadequate supply, which actually has its roots back as far as 2007 and the collapse of the mortgage market, and those effects are still being felt today. Development cost and the timeline to deliver new housing, and then the financial return limits that are out there, particularly if that housing is going to be affordable. So we're going to dig into each of these in just a little more detail. Inadequate supply can result from a number of factors. In some communities, it's a lack of having capable developers or resources available to construct that housing. In high demand markets, it's often a lack of access to affordable land. And there's so much market pressure out there on the land that just being able to secure a site for affordable or workforce housing and the price associated with that makes the project infeasible. And in addition, in some communities, the scale of the housing need is such that in a rural community, you maybe need a smaller scale development, and getting access to the kind of capital you need to undertake that development or to renovate an existing facility can often be harder to come by. All those factors impact housing supply. On the financial return side, the housing market in general has become more corporatized and has become the target of investment banking. And there's an expected return on investment. And that return on investment drives money to the top end of the market to invest in properties that are hitting the highest level of returns. And that means charging the highest level of rents. That has fed into this gap that we've got in both workforce and affordable housing. In other instances, when we're undertaking efforts to do urban revitalization or working in a neighborhood or community that may be economically distressed, the sale price of a newly constructed home is below what that house might appraise for, or the apartment rents at an affordable level are not going to justify the mortgage needed to support that development. And so the financial returns in order to accomplish affordable housing become dependent upon other forms of public and private subsidies and supports to make that housing feasible. And that again puts a damper on the number of housing units that we've got available. Then, from a cost and timeline standpoint, one of the other things we're contending with is, you find a site that's suitable, it could be acquired at a reasonable price, but it's got other challenges. It may have infrastructure challenges. And specifically today, we're talking about environmental cleanup costs. And that property may be available at a reasonable price because of the geotechnical or environmental impacts that are in place that need to be addressed. Or site acquisition itself could be too costly to make the project feasible. So we want to talk for a moment about the brownfield considerations, and I'm going to hand this back to Mary for a moment to speak in a little more detail about some of those brownfield considerations when we're looking at housing as a redevelopment strategy.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
So obviously, brownfield sites have some form of contamination, and it may be simple, asbestos that needs to be abated. But when you're talking about a site that actually has soil and or groundwater contamination, you need to be particularly careful in siting housing on that site. What we have found in our redevelopment practice is that sometimes you need to modify your cleanup in order to accommodate the development you want to put on a brownfield site. Other times you can modify your site design and actually make design modifications that can help ameliorate the effects of the contamination that's there. This is a picture from a recent brownfield development that my development company, RE Solutions, has undertaken at the site of a former dry cleaner in Denver. And this is showing a vapor barrier being placed in the basement, in the underground areas of the building in order to provide vapor protection and mitigation for soil and groundwater vapors. This is the project. We call it 29X because it's at 29th Avenue and Xavier Street. But it was a former small neighborhood commercial and dry cleaner site that we purchased about 5 years ago and have completed the cleanup and have undertaken redevelopment of the project. We designed the building in a way that has a level of podium parking so that it creates an open air, naturally ventilated layer for vapor protection for most of the building. And then actual vapor barriers are put in below any occupied spaces on the ground floor. This is a market rate apartment, 42 unit apartment building, 1 and 2 bedrooms. We designed it very efficiently. We have rooftop solar that powers all the electricity in the common area. We have chargers in the electric vehicle chargers in the garage. And this is basically the view of the building pretty currently. It's going to be occupied or get a certificate of occupancy in a couple of months. We expect it to be turned over to us. We've already signed some leases. We took advantage of both the Colorado State Voluntary Cleanup Program as well as a revolving loan fund loan for this site. So this has had funding through some creative EPA brownfield funding sources. I'll be happy to answer any questions about that site. But basically, all of the factors that Tom has talked about in terms of the challenges for housing contribute to the lack of adequate housing in general. Inadequate supply, development costs, the demand for returns in the private development market. So this is how public agencies, federal funding, local and state funding, and local community development corporations and other nonprofits can really step into this gap and help provide housing and solutions where the private sector cannot. So we are going to be talking further about how these programs come together, in particular the funding side to support affordable and workhouse development. So one of the things we'd like to know is what is the biggest challenge that you're facing in redeveloping a brownfield site for housing? We had almost 90% of the audience here has considered brownfield site for housing. So, curious about what you're finding is the biggest challenges. And if a challenge you faced is not on this list, please type it into the Q&A. Just add a comment and let us know what your experience is and what challenges you faced. We definitely will be reading those back and we'll be giving you some feedback on these choices. So, the ones that we identified were a problem with site assembly. Maybe you need to assemble multiple parcels in order to have a site that's big enough to do your housing development. Maybe you don't have the environmental remediation expertise to know how to address the contamination on a brownfield. Is funding a problem? Is the actual development expertise a problem? Or is there some lack of community or political will that prevents you from looking at brownfields? And maybe there's others. Maybe it's stigma, maybe it's a fear of liability, maybe it's difficulty attracting developers. Whatever your experience, respond to the poll. And then if you have others, please go ahead and type it into the Q&A for us.
Mary, it looks like about half of the audience have shared their responses directly in that poll. I'm starting to see those responses slow down, but we are getting some comments there into the Q&A that a lot of indications are multiple choices here have been relevant to them. So they've experienced all of these challenges at some of their sites. I'm going to go ahead and just encourage the audience to think through again, just make a quick selection and then hit that submit button. And then, of course, as Mary said, you can provide more context or other answers in that Q&A. And remember, you also have the options to scroll through and read what others are putting in. So if someone else has defined a custom response and it's also been a big challenge for you, you can give it a thumbs up or a click that little like button underneath it, and we'll know that that's been a common issue for you. So, seeing that about 60% of you have shared your responses, I'll close that poll in 3, 2, 1. And let's take a look at the distribution of results. So, almost half, the biggest challenge by about 47% came in the phrase of access to funding. That was the largest challenge. And I would say that's also consistent with some of the clarification that we've gotten in the Q&A. Some people are noting that the price of brownfield sites is excessive. Or they have issues with infrastructure developments. There are unknown developers and investors, and they can't find the people. And that's the challenge to kind of bring those parties together.
Yes, for sure.
But it does look like by far access to funding was the number one challenge.
Wonderful. Well, that is not a surprise. We see that in all kinds of brownfield development issues. We're going to take a break for some Q&A here. So, Jean, you want to plug into our questions and let's see if we can address some of the questions that the audience has or the participants here have raised.
Absolutely. And I'm going to ask Sam if you could come on video as well. And we'll pause here briefly to take some questions. Okay, so let's jump in. And for the attendees who may have joined us a little bit late, you'll have access to a Q&A window where you can type in questions and comments. If you haven't been doing so, go ahead and click that box and open it up now. You'll be able to see in the All tab all the messages that have come in from other attendees. So you can scroll up and down and you'll find a little thumbs up icon under each question. So you can like if you agree with a particular question or comment that's come in to the Q&A. I'm going to read through some of the questions though that came in earlier, and this one did get a few votes about grant applications and RFPs. So Sam, I think this one might be for you. One of the attendees wanted to know how would they be notified about the grant application, about those RFPs? They wanted to know if there's a point of contact at EPA that they should follow up with.
Thank you, Jean. I can address that question. So the best way to be notified about new RFPs is by joining our listserv. We'll send out an email every time we post a new grant opportunity, and I can I want to share a link with the chat. Would that be possible?
Yeah, if you put it in the chat, I'll get it out to the audience.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'll share the link to the listserv with Jean, and she will share it with you. But yep, every new opportunity we'll send out an announcement email, and you should be able to access it from there.
Okay. Mary, I have a question from one of the participants about the dry cleaner site, and they're wondering if you did soil vapor extraction or just mitigation there.
That was from Lenny. Thank you, Lenny. Nice to see you here. We actually did two things. We did three things. We did source soil removal, so we did a fair amount of soil remediation. And then we did two forms of groundwater treatment. We have cleaned up the site to state standards, but the mitigation we're doing is a sort of belts and suspenders on top of the cleanup that was done. Thanks for your question.
Okay. How about certificate of occupancy? Where does that come from?
That comes from the city, from the municipality. So that is a threshold permit for any new construction on a brownfield or otherwise that says when you have passed all of your inspections for the development for the construction, you get a certificate of occupancy, and then the building can be open to the public.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some of the housing availability study results that Tom had discussed. Have there been or were there any studies that looked into the possible impacts that individuals with multiple properties or the quote house flippers or the rise of VBRO or Airbnb might have contributed to the housing market and its current low numbers?
Yeah, we've certainly seen, depending on the community, particularly if it's more of a resort community, that there are significant impacts on housing prices and availability, most importantly, from things like Airbnb and VRBO. Depending on the specific market location, a market analyst would be able to look at historical data and see what the number of those types of units have been in a given marketplace and the impact that that has on housing affordability and availability. We've also seen in communities that certain jurisdictions have taken steps to put additional taxation on those units or other restrictions that help to fund housing affordability and create workforce housing through a pool of local funding resources that in part come out of those short-term rentals. It's a complicated policy issue. It has very much to do with local laws, both at the state, county, and municipal level. But it's definitely an impact that we're seeing on housing affordability.
Okay. And I see a couple of upvotes and a few related questions about challenges developing brownfield sites, specifically getting into contamination levels. Some of the attendees are asking, you know, at what point is it too severe in terms of contamination to redevelop a site? They're just curious what level of remediation or cleanup might be necessary. What if they have contaminants in the vadose zone? What about groundwater conditions? So, Sam,
All
some people are asking you, but Mary, I see you're ready to jump in, so go right ahead.
of the Sam, do you want to respond?
You can go ahead and answer first, Mary, and I'll
Okay.
chime in.
Well, I'll just say that these are all very site-specific questions. We've certainly encountered some sites that I would say are too expensive to remediate adequately for residential reuse, and some that are technically infeasible to remediate to residential reuse. But largely, we have found very few sites that were too contaminated for some type of redevelopment. And I saw one question in particular addressing a petroleum storage tank farm. We've actually, in our career as brownfield developers, developed a number of former petroleum refineries as brownfield sites, one of which was redeveloped into housing. And that is certainly possible. A lot will depend on the underlying value of the real estate and whether or not there's enough value there that can be recovered to pay for the cost of the cleanup and to develop the housing. But great questions. And I would just say, explore these with your state environmental agency, with your regional TAB, technical assistance to brownfield providers. Get some technical assistance to help you navigate those questions because it's feasible, but very site specific.
All right. Well, I hate to do it because there are some great questions still in the queue. I would not be doing my job if I didn't keep an eye on the time here. So I think just in the interest of time, we will pause our Q&A break, but we are going to come back to some of the questions and comments. I'll allow the audience to scroll through some other messages that may have come in and to give some upvotes if they too share some of the questions that we have left in the queue. And at this point, I want to turn the floor back to my presenters, and I'll just remind the audience, keep those questions and comments coming in, keep those votes coming in, and we will carry on with our presentation and pause in just a little bit for another Q&A break shortly.
Great. Thanks, Jean.
So in this next section, we wanted to spend just a little bit of time talking about how are these housing development transactions and projects actually created, and particularly when we're looking at redevelopment of brownfield sites or even sites that are technically brownfields, but you may not know if they're environmentally impacted. They're just a vacant, unused site, they still fall in that brownfield category. And what becomes critical in many of those instances to jumpstart development is to have engagement with local nonprofit organizations and public agencies. And that can be done in collaboration with the private development community. So we're going to talk a little bit about how those transactions are created. So some of the critical things to consider we've identified here. We talked about those different levels of median income where the funding and financing programs are targeted, and understanding where the needs are in your community relative to those different income levels and the type of housing, whether it's for sale or multifamily rental development or supportive housing or shelter housing for unhoused people. It's very important to understand where the need is at and to also understand what specific challenges are you facing in your community. It could be that construction costs are very high, or that land costs are very high, or that your construction costs maybe don't look out of line nationally, but the income levels in your community are far below what would support the development of new housing. That becomes really important to understand exactly what the needs of your site and your community are, so that you can then take that next step of deciding what role is your organization going to play, or what role do you need your public sector partners or nonprofit partners to play in this transaction. And all of that gets to how to catalyze these developments and actually get projects underway. So we're going to dig into each of these topics just a little bit. So as we look at challenges, there can be any number of challenges. I'm not going to read all of these off. We've touched on many of these challenges, But understanding and evaluating the market conditions in your community and the specific obstacles that come with redeveloping a particular site are very important. Then defining what roles need to be played, because if housing or other development isn't taking place in your community, well, what role can you play to overcome those hurdles? That could be things like identifying all the potential development sites in your area that might be targets, actually facilitating the acquisition and assembly of those sites on the front end so that you could then engage with a private developer or a nonprofit developer to facilitate the housing construction on that site. Helping to orchestrate funding and financing resources are another strategy that can be used. Addressing things related to site development or remediation, these could be geotechnical issues. They get into infrastructure related capacity for that site. All of those things can help jumpstart the process and make a project more feasible, where a private developer might not be willing to come in and spend an inordinate amount of time assembling sites or working through utility infrastructure redevelopment. The role of the private sector is often to look for a partner on the public sector nonprofit side to help shorten that development timeline. And then we get into the rest of the funding and financing resources, providing subordinate debt, writing down the cost of a for sale home so that it's affordable to somebody at a lower income level. Or making initial investments to help get pre-development activities through the permitting and entitlement process funded. And that can all then lead up to issuing a developer RFP. And we'll talk a little bit about that. One of the roles, key roles that the public sector and nonprofit sector can play are listed here. So we touched on its acquisition, actually managing the remediation and cleanup of a site to that residential site standard so that that's not a risk that the private developer takes on. Getting the infrastructure in place, but it's the funding and financing resources that will help fund that infrastructure. And then providing other tools, whether it's the renovation of an existing property, like we saw in that historic cotton mill. Providing construction period financing, which can often be a challenge for these projects, or orchestrating permanent mortgage financing. All of these things help to get a project that otherwise wouldn't be financially feasible to a point that it's going to generate the kind of return on investment that'll attract private developers. In terms of being a catalyst, and I saw some of the questions, during our prior break, touched on this specific issue, and that's building that community consensus. And we saw a fair number of the people in the prior poll identified, in addition to funding resources, having the political will to undertake these projects. Often there's some grassroots efforts that are required to actually build consensus and build momentum to make the investments necessary. And that's a critical role that public sector organizations and nonprofits can play in getting community support in place so that when it comes time to submit planning and zoning approvals, and all the other entitlements required to develop a site, that there's already a level of community support, for that effort. In many instances, the presence of local funding commitments, matching funds to go with federal or state funds are critical to compete for those funding resources. So, real cash money is needed at the local level to at least cover a small portion of that project, even if the bigger strategy is to pursue tax credits or some of these other funding resources that we'll talk about. In all of this, it's really important to be clear-headed in looking at the resources of your community and your organization, what the needs are of the site and what the needs are in the market, and then making very deliberate decisions about what role can my organization play? What role do I need the city or the county to play? What resources may I need from a state level government so that your role is very clear in all of this? And that may mean that you're going to have to bring other technical resources, consultants, advisors, or a developer with the expertise to undertake the project. But formulating that plan and being clear about what things you're capable of doing and what things you're not going to be able to do without some additional resources and support, all of that leads to developing a strategy for execution that's got clear timelines, as a budget, and is tied to addressing those objectives that you've got for affordability within your community, what sector of the market you're going to try and address, and the challenges of a particular development site. So we wanted to take a moment and talk about another example. This particular project is in Silver City, New Mexico. It's the site of what was a former hospital that had served the community for almost 100 years. The original buildings dated back to 1937. In this instance, the city played a key role in actually getting site control of the site, managing site demolition and remediation, and then engaging a private developer to undertake the creation of 1 and 2 bedrooms apartments. And this specific development was targeted towards providing senior housing. Again, over $9 million in federal tax credits came to this program under the low-income housing tax credit program. And you'll see there's an image of the building. There were some pretty significant environmental impacts on this site related to the operation of the hospital and many of the controls and protections that are in place today didn't exist in the 1930s and 40s in particular. And so there were brownfield grants and loans that came to the table to make this project feasible and to create this new housing. And we thought this example was important as well because it came from a smaller, more mid-size community in a somewhat remote area, but it shows a good example of the fact that this housing development can occur in a lot of different places. So, with all of that said, we thought one of the things that would be important is to also understand where you're seeing the greatest need for housing. This may help us inform future information we provide, and we'll try and tailor some of our comments, but where do you see the greatest need? Is that in market rate, workforce, affordable housing levels, or housing that serves unhoused people or folks that are in need of permanent supportive services?
All right. And so, Tom, with this particular pop-up question that's appeared, this is a check all that apply. So you get to pick more than one. And I'll echo that option as well. Remember, the Q&A is available. So if you have others, you're welcome to type in custom responses into the Q&A. And then, of course, you can upvote or give a thumbs up to responses as they're coming into the Q&A if you share those as need for housing in your community. It looks like about half of the audience have indicated a response in that pop-up window or poll. I'll give you all just a few more seconds to think about it and then submit your responses in. And just add a quick clarification, if you don't see messages in the Q&A, you might need to close it, open it up, and then look at the All tab and scroll up and down because there are a number of questions and comments that have come in. So you might need to go up and down to find the most recent submissions. All right, looking at these poll responses slowing down, I'll go ahead and close this poll out in 3, 2, 1. And with about 2/3 of the audience having responded, affordable, housing is the greatest need. About 80% of them picked that. But workforce in unhoused and supportive housing also showed up pretty high there as in terms of their needs as well. I'm scrolling through here. And again, I'm starting to see unhoused and supportive workforce, affordable market rate in that order in those custom responses.
And I think that's not surprising based on what we're seeing nationally, but I think there's growing recognition that this need within the workforce housing realm is also an ever-increasing need. So we're also at a point here, we've tried to break up our presentation as we presented different chunks of information to deal with some questions. So maybe we can have Sam and Mary come back online and we'll take a few moments to address some of the questions.
Absolutely. So again, I'm going to start reading through these questions. Again, for the audience members, you all can continue to vote on the ones that have already come into the queue. Let me go ahead and go back to a question that came in earlier and has gotten the most votes by far. And this was a comment that came in about the wonderful Brownfields grants that we have. And they note that it would be great if you could provide a housing assistance grant. If you could provide even modest funding for staff and planning, as well as dedicated TA for rural communities to work with their communities, find developers, identify funding options, ID the cleanup plan. And I'm seeing even more likes coming in as I'm reading that message. So I just wanted to relay that comment. And if the speakers have a response to that, please, by all means, feel free to unmute.
Sam, I think this one's yours.
Sure. Thanks, Alyssa, for that great question. And I think that the resource that we have available that would be most relevant to you is our technical assistance to Brownfields providers. We have six grantees across the country for each EPA region, and they give really general assistance, and they have a really wide range of expertise for all issues related to brownfields, and they're able to, dedicate time to you and your community to address any specific questions and concerns that you have.
ADAPTA is a technical assistance to Brownfields provider TAB partner for many of the EPA regions. And we see a lot of requests for assistance with planning, assistance with community engagement, assistance with identifying funding sources, identifying developers. How do we attract developers to our community? These are all the kinds of challenges that the TAB providers can help communities with. So I'd encourage you to reach out to your TAB, the TAB provider in your region.
Okay. And we did have some dialogue and a few different questions that came in with individuals noting that sometimes there can be groups that may protest or slow down projects. And wondering if there were tips or tricks for educating the public on redevelopment. And I think, Tom, you already brought this up, and Mary, about engaging the community and making them aware and building those partnerships. So I just wanted to see if there's any further response on those recommendations.
Yeah, Gina, I would add that I think one of the most important things you can do to start this process is community education. And it's identifying what challenges you've got in your community. So helping people understand that, the average teacher in your community makes this amount of money. And that means that person can only afford this amount of rent, or could only afford to buy a house at current interest rates of this amount of money, but it's going to cost more than that to build that housing unit. There's a lot of homework to be done to help provide clear communication to communities about what those challenges are. But I think that information and educating people helps people understand the magnitude of the challenge, and that, there's got to be a concerted effort locally to make some sacrifices, to make it a funding priority, to identify sites, all of those things. So I would put community education at the core of that.
I would second that with regards to community engagement and having a real dialogue. So many of these questions that I've seen have to do with, people using contamination as a reason to stop a project that is otherwise has objections in the community. I think that the groundwork has to be done to understand what those concerns are in the community. You know, are they truly technical risk-based concerns about the contamination, or are there other concerns with the kind of development that's happening in the community? There's a very deep level of community engagement that is necessary around brownfields development so that you're not just going forward and presenting a community with what the plans are, but that you're engaging them in the decision process. A truly authentic community engagement effort can often help with a lot of these situations. ADAPTA has entered into a partnership with Community Lattice, who has very, very strong community engagement and public participation skills. And we're finding that that is just so important, that being transparent and informing and bringing the community into the decision-making process can make the difference between a project that goes forward and one that stalls.
Okay, I'm going to take one last question, and this is at the top of the voting pool, and then we'll carry on here. One of the attendees speaking in, of how you engage with communities noted that they've done some work regarding messaging and framing for affordable housing in order to get community buy-in. And many resources suggest using different language. So workforce housing or housing that is affordable rather than calling it affordable housing. They note that one of you mentioned that different regulations exist for different names and language, so affordable housing versus workforce housing. And they wanted to know if you could just speak more on that and let them know about other thoughts or suggestions for messaging and framing in support of affordable housing developments.
I'll tackle that one. So let me first speak to kind of funding and financing. And very briefly, the tax credit program is targeted to serve families at or 60% of area median income. I will touch on some of the other mortgage insurance programs designed for workforce housing, and I'll deal with that a little later in the presentation. I think what's really important, though, is to bring these nebulous, what, you know, the average citizen may seem a really nebulous idea of like, what is 60% of an area's median income? That needs to be boiled down to, okay, well, this means a person who makes this much money in our community on an annual basis, this is what they would earn on an annual rate. And then be able to speak to how many jobs in your community are at that level of income? How many people are actually, living their lives at that level of salary, and what does that mean for them from a housing standpoint? The other phrase that gets kicked around is attainable housing. But I think when you put these income levels in the context of actual jobs in people's communities and they can translate that into their own salary, it brings that conversation home in a different way. But Mary or Sam, I don't know, maybe there's some things you want.
I think they're on board.
Yeah, I agree. And I would note that there's demographic information out there and market studies that can be done to help provide that information to communities if they don't already have it.
All right. So it is unfortunately time to close this Q&A break. And I'm just going to do a quick time check. We have approximately 27 minutes left. Ladies and gentlemen, and lots of good content to get through. So I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of your speakers, and we will pause for questions in just a little bit.
Okay, thanks, Jean. So the next part of the presentation, we really want to focus on addressing funding gaps. And you can think about those funding gaps in three major areas: the kind of early stage or risk capital funding that's needed. And this can really help shorten the timeline for a developer. So time spent and money spent on acquisition, site prep, remediation, infrastructure, all of that from a developer standpoint shortens the time frame. If they've got a site that's environmentally clean, has the infrastructure it needs, you've dealt with geotechnical soil engineering issues, and you've found a way to cover the cost of that either through grants or other public funding, that's a major chunk. And we'll talk about what programs are out there to help with that. Construction period financing, helping write down interest rates during the construction period, that's higher cost capital if it's sought from a private source of funding, or a commercial lender. And this funding can often be repaid with other permanent mortgage debt down the road. And then finally, we get to subordinate debt, and that can help on both the rental side or the for sale side. But this is patient money that sits behind a first mortgage, is typically funded with some source of either philanthropic money or public sector programs, but stays as debt on the property over the long term, but at a very low interest rate or terms that mean that only if cash flow hits a certain level does it ever get repaid, or some of it may simply stay as debt to ensure the affordability of a property over the long term. So I'm going to kind of run through federal and state resources. I'm going to go through this information fairly quickly. There are links in this presentation to all of these resources, so you can dig deeper on this information, but bear with me while we go through quite a bit of information fairly quickly here. So there's a number of federal funding resources out there. The tax credit program is the largest and most impactful funding program out there for creating affordable housing. The HOME program, HUD's largest program, is out there. And then we're going to talk about National Housing Trust, the mortgage insurance programs, operating subsidies that are out there, and then the programs that are designed specifically to assist rural communities. So on the infrastructure and site work side of things, community development block grants, USDA rural development funding, and EPA funding are all well positioned to deal with those environmental site conditions. And it's often a blend of these monies that come into a project to address those site-related conditions. The Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program is a program through the U.S. Department of the Treasury because it is a credit against other tax liabilities. There are several links here on this slide that you can go to that will give you a better description of the mechanisms. I'm going to go through some of that. But at a big picture level, here's the important things to know. Nationally, there is a pool annually of tax credits to build affordable housing. Those tax credits get allocated to a state housing finance agency, and you see the National Council of State Housing Agencies there. You can go to their website, find information about, if you don't know who the housing finance agency is in your state, you can find that information there. They receive these tax credits and they put them out on a competitive basis. There's two types of credits: the 4% credit, which is paired with public bond financing, and the 9% credit. And just as the titles exist, the 4% credit is a little more shallow form of subsidy. The 9% credit offers a deeper level of subsidy. And here's a diagram that explains how that program works. So first of all, every dollar in tax credit that's issued translates into $1 in tax reduction or tax liability. These tax credits are sold. The pricing at which they're sold depends on the community and also depends on overall market conditions within the broader financial markets nationally. Typically, those credits are going to be sold for anywhere between 87 cents and 97 cents on the dollar. It's sometimes even higher than that. It's occasionally been lower than that, and it varies over time. Again, the IRS sends the credits to the states. The states undertake a competitive process through the development of what's called a Qualified Allocation Plan, a QAP. Every state has a QAP, and it's the rules of the road for how you access these tax credits in your state. Some states are highly competitive in that they may receive three, four, or five applications for every credit award that they make. So there may be a pool of as many as five projects out there, and only one of those five projects is going to get funded in a given round of funding. There's often multiple rounds, two or even three rounds, depending on your state. Some states just have one round, but the QAP is the document you want to look to. The credits flow from the State Housing Finance Agency to the housing developer, which could be a nonprofit or a for-profit developer. And then that developer sells those tax credits to an investor who has a tax liability. Most commonly in today's environment, that's a bank or a life insurance entity or some other kind of institutional source of capital. And they buy those credits. So if you've got $10 million in credits and they're sold at 90 cents on the dollar, then you're going to get $9 million in equity that would come into your housing development project to make that project feasible. And what comes along with that money is an obligation for that housing to remain affordable for a period of at least 15 years. And there's a compliance period during the first 10 years, but it's important to know that in almost every state today, because the environment is so competitive for these tax credits, most states are requiring an additional 15 years. So it's a 30-year affordability commitment. And that's recorded as a covenant on the title of the property. So, as the property owner, you've got to maintain that affordable rent level, depending on the family's income, for the entirety of that 30 years. So, that's a very brief description of what's a fairly complicated program, and you've got some resources to go learn more about it. One of the biggest programs out there in terms of providing additional funding at the community level comes through HUD's Home Investment Program. This can develop housing to serve households up to 80% of the area median income. There is a local match for those funds. If you are in a larger urban area, that the administration of those funds is handled at the city level. If you're outside of a major city called an entitlement community, it's handled at the state level. And each, whether at the city or the state level, they will each publish their own consolidated plan that describes their priorities and what housing initiatives they hope to address. Going back a few years ago at the federal level was the creation of the National Housing Trust Fund. The most recent data from 2022, close to $19 million went out nationally. 80% of that money has to go into the rental housing market, 10% goes for home ownership, and I think only 10% of the money can be used for administrative cost at the community or state level. These links give you more information on that. It's important to know these funds are often paired with a tax credit application or some other source of funding to fill that gap. So in most instances, even workforce housing, but certainly affordable housing, requires multiple funding programs and sources to actually get a deal through construction and delivered to market. Some of the other really important programs that are out there at the federal level are through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Rural Development. They are federal mortgage insurance programs that bring with them affordability requirements. They're at lower interest rates than commercially available. The amortization terms go up to between 35 and 40 years, much longer than commercial mortgage. And so the debt service is much lower using these programs. This is a link to all of the different programs. Going back to the 2000s, the Federal Housing Finance Agency was created to provide oversight of Fannie, Freddie, and the Federal Home Loan Bank. The Rural Development Administration under USDA operates very similar programs with very similar rules. You work with a conventional private sector lender, but one who is qualified and certified to make loans under these programs. The bank underwrites the loan and handles the servicing of the loan, but the loan is actually then insured by, or in some instances, sold to one of these financing entities, depending on the specific program. In the instance of for sale housing, owner-occupied housing, those mortgages are sold. They're actually purchased through Fannie or Freddie or through the Home Loan Bank. So here's a different example of a housing development project. This was done in Honolulu, Hawaii. We know we've got a lot of people from EPA Region 9 who are participating in the call today. This is a 111-unit, 16-story high-rise built on a site that had storage of old oil drums, had a dry cleaner on the site. This particular project used the 4% tax credit program with bond financing, and a number of the units were restricted at even lower levels of income for residents who were making at or below 30% of the area's median income. And this site was renovated. So this gives you just a view of the different scale of development that can be done, tapped into the Target Brownfield Assessment Grant, as well as state level funding for phase two assessments, and then a state level response program grant as well. And similar to 29X, there was some site capping, but also a parking deck that went over these impacted areas, and then the housing was built above that. So it was a way to address that environmental impact on that particular site. Another important resource, and this is available nationally, is the Federal Home Loan Bank. This is a system of 11 regional banks, and each banking district operates its own programs. Here's a national map of where those banking associations are located. So it's a cooperative association of banks in different states. The funding programs they provide under the AHP program, which taps into 10% of the net income of the banks, goes back into this affordable housing program. And that's a statutory requirement. When this banking association was created. Also, a portion of the money goes into the community investment program, which can be used for a variety of economic development, infrastructure development, and can be tapped into by public sector agencies, as well as the community investment cash advance program. So take a look at these programs. If your communities aren't taking advantage of these programs, they may be able to use these to assist local public agencies in improving their financial position, and that could free up money to tackle affordable housing. A different kind of strategy in funding programs are Section 8 vouchers. We've heard about these for years. They're now often called housing choice vouchers. There's a specific form of these that are project-based. That is, the vouchers don't travel with the resident as they may move from property to property. The vouchers stay with the property. A person has to be income qualified to take advantage of those, but because they stay with the property, it can help secure additional mortgage financing because it will boost the overall revenue while keeping it affordable for the tenant. The property will receive a subsidy payment to support that tenant's rent. And these project-based vouchers are often paired with one of the mortgage insurance programs through FHA, Freddie Mac, or Fannie. Rural development, I just want to provide these specific links. Very similar programs to what Fannie, Freddie, and FHA offer, targeted specifically towards rural communities. So if you're in a smaller community, you've got a designated source of money. You could tap into these other federal programs, but through USDA Rural Development, these are targeted to your community to build both single family and multifamily housing. And it's a mix of both direct loans, guaranteed loans, and rental assistance. Another important thing here relative to brownfields, there's home repair and improvement. And we know many rural communities have got some percentage of housing that's dilapidated or abandoned or just in really poor shape. USDA has got some programs to specifically help with home repair and improvement to address some of those things. Mentioned these programs before, just wanted to highlight them again. The Community Development Block Grant is a huge source of money for housing and infrastructure development in communities, as well as USDA rural development resources. Often these funding sources are critical to making the housing projects work. So that's the housing sources. I'm going to invite Mary or and Sam maybe to come back, talk a little bit more about EPA OBLR and state environmental Environment Department funding resources.
Thanks, Tom. Sam, oh, there you are. Good. There have been a couple of questions in the Q&A about funding for various activities, including site acquisition. In general, I don't know of any EPA or other federal grant programs that provide money for site acquisition. That is one of the challenges with brownfields, is getting the funding to actually buy the site to begin with. It's very difficult to get debt, either for cleanup or construction, and certainly not for acquisition on a brownfield site. So that's a big challenge. And I don't know of any sources of funding for that right now. Sam, you may know otherwise.
No, I don't have anything to add on that, but yeah, I'll just endorse our own grant programs again. Since Congress allocated some bipartisan infrastructure law funding to our program in 2022, we've had more resources available than ever before. That was an additional $1.5 billion in funding over the 5 years. So at least for the next 2 to 3 years, we have a lot more funding available to our communities. Our grants are larger sizes than they had been previously. So yet for all assessment activities, cleanup planning, cleanup activities, please explore our brownfield grant options and apply if it's relevant to your community in the next grant cycle.
And as a on the private development side, again, my sister company, RE Solutions, is an acquisition and development company. And we took advantage of the state of Colorado's revolving loan fund to get a loan for the cleanup at that 29X apartment project I talked about. The revolving loan funds are a great source of subordinated debt, essentially, that will pay for cleanup costs, that will finance cleanup costs. It's not a grant. Ideally, it has to be repaid, although for municipalities and nonprofits, there are portions of that loan that can be forgivable, or there can be a subgrant made as well, depending on the particular RLF program. So that is a very critical piece of financing that isn't often well understood and certainly not used as much as I think it could and should be. But it's a great option, and it's one of the few EPA sources of funding for brownfields that's available to the private sector. So that's something to remember.
Great, thank you.
I recommend, given the time, that we skip this last case study. It'll be in the presentation materials, but I want to give enough time to recap and to address a couple of more questions from the audience. So I think that this is important stuff, and I want to make sure we're responding.
And Mary, I want to just add to what you were just saying in this question about site acquisition. It's very often the case that the local community philanthropy or a local public agency will undertake the acquisition of a site, but that money can get counted as the matching funds that a community is putting on the table to pursue a community development block grant or matching funds for one of these EPA programs. So you've really got to think about all the funding and financing very holistically. because in order to compete for many of these public sources, you've got to show a public funding commitment to have real skin in the game. And the sooner you know, doing that at the early stage of the project is often the best way to catalyze it. So, just briefly on the recap, the three big points we really wanted to emphasize is you need to understand your local situation. There's these programs that are available at the national level. You've got to figure out exactly what the needs are in your community and then how you're going to tailor your strategy to meet those needs. Creating a very clear strategy based on your local resources that you've got and being kind of clear-headed about where you've got gaps and challenges in those resources. And then being very deliberate in your implementation, building that community consensus, setting out a timeline, and having the support to actually turn this from idea into real housing. So, with that, I think we can open it up to questions at this point.
All right, well done. I do want to point out we have some questions in the queue, and I'm going to lead in with the most important question or the one that's gotten the most upvotes right now. So it's sitting at the top. This is asking if anyone on the panel can speak to HUD financing requirements and its preference for complete quote closure, no further action determinations versus risk-based closure determinations. The participant goes on to say that we often get inquiries from developers seeking HUD-related financing who don't have a quote clean site.
So I'll jump in and speak, to my experience in working with public housing authorities and a variety of nonprofits doing affordable housing development. We always had to be on enrolled in the state's voluntary cleanup program was the most common approach, and moving towards a no further action level that was driven by a residential standard. Now, in terms of the actual strategy that could be used, that didn't mean that we had to do 100% remediation. There may have been impacted soils that were buried at depth, and then a vapor barrier was put below the building, or parking was put at a ground level. So it didn't mean returning that site to a completely pristine condition. But it did mean putting in the institutional controls, including some of the ongoing monitoring, to make absolutely certain that it was safe for human habitation, particularly when we've got children living on the site.
Okay. I'm also just going to acknowledge that there are people asking for copies of the presentation materials. I promise you, we are going to show you where you can download those. That'll be one of the final reminders that I share with you all. I did put the link to the seminar homepage. So if you want to scroll up, I have given that direct link, but I will include that link and a reminder on accessing all of the resources and sharing your feedback before we close out today. So I think I can squeeze in just sort of one additional observation that's come in a few different formats. This is a broad sort of question. A number of participants have asked or voted on questions asking about keeping the community informed of historic contamination. So how residents are notified about historic contamination or post-occupancy monitoring to ensure that that contamination is not an issue in the future. And I'm not sure if any of the speakers could speak a bit to that.
I will say that once again, this is often a very site-specific issue. With regards to notification of historic contamination, I would say that it depends on what remains there. Most of the sites that I have been involved in, where we've purchased and developed, they have had some sort of deed notice or covenants that require notification, and whether it's in leases to tenants or whether it's in purchase and sale agreements, there's always on most of our sites a notice about the historic contamination. In cases where it's been cleaned up to an unconditional closure, that's probably not necessary. But that's been my experience, is that we tend to err on the side of more disclosures rather than less.
All right, excellent. Sam, I'm going to make one last pitch. You mentioned this earlier. We did have some people who joined a little bit late. How can they stay informed of funding opportunities from the Brownfields program? Would you mind sharing that answer again?
Yeah, thanks, Jean. We have a Brownfields listserv where you'll get all notifications up for funding opportunities, as well as a lot of other great pieces of information from our program. You would have even gotten this invitation to this webinar from that listserv. So if you're not on it already, I recommend that you sign up for it. It's on the Brownfields website, and hopefully we'll be able to share the link with you as well.
Absolutely. All right, we are right up at 2:30, so I did want to turn it back to our speakers here if there are any final thoughts they'd like to leave the audience with before I conclude with our final closeout reminders.
I would just say take a hard look at the brownfield sites in your community, and given that we're facing such a huge national need for housing, be aggressive in thinking about how those could be good opportunities, knowing that you've got to meet those residential cleanup standards and make sure it's safe and healthy for everybody. But this can be a great opportunity to bring resources together. It really can.
Couldn't agree more, Tom. And I know that there were a number of questions that we weren't able to get to. We'd invite the participants to follow up with us directly. Happy to continue the conversation offline. Thank you all for coming and really appreciate all the input and the engagement.
Yep. And thank you so much, Tom and Mary, for sharing your expertise with everyone. It was a really informative session. Thank you to all the attendees for participating and asking engaging questions. And thank you, Jean, so much for hosting and all the work that you did behind the scenes to make this happen.
Well, thank you all so very much. And on that note, I will keep the audience with us for just a minute longer to walk through a few final reminders before we officially close things out today. So, the first thing that I wanted to point out is that I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org. We also have a free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, that I send out on the first of each month, which would highlight sessions like today. So, if you're involved in characterizing or cleaning up hazardous waste sites, please be sure to visit us or sign up for our free newsletter as well. But probably the most important final reminder I can share with you is that we do have a seminar homepage. That seminar homepage contains all of the information for today's particular session. So it's the URL that's shown in red at the top of this slide. We had that URL pasted earlier into some responses to the questions that came in. That particular homepage has information and contact details for our presenters. There are links to download the presentation contents and all of those case studies and links to funding sources. Those have all been curated and placed here in the related link section. So I encourage you to visit this website, bookmark it. You can share it with other individuals that you think would find it helpful. We have all of that information posted here and it will be available from today forward. And I will also point out our feedback form link is available on that seminar homepage because if you would like to receive a participation certificate for joining us in today's live delivery, I'll kindly ask that you complete that seminar feedback form. Again, it's part of that seminar homepage. And simply make sure when you submit your feedback to check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you were here for the entire delivery. And then as soon as you fill out that form and submit it, you'll have access to a certificate that you can download or print out for your own records. I'll email a copy to you as well, but those sometimes get caught up in junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download it right from that confirmation screen. If you hosted a viewing party at your location, please send the link to the seminar homepage to anybody who joined you, and they can actually share their own feedback, even though they didn't register on their own and get their own certificate of participation. Today's session was recorded. It usually takes me about 1 week to post those. You will automatically get an email once that archived session is available for on-demand playback. Again, in that archived session, if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying it right about now in the recorded version, above my head in the upper right, there'll be a button to this seminar homepage and a button to that feedback form. So even if you're watching the recorded version, you can still head over to the feedback form, share your feedback, check the box to say you watched the whole archive, and then get a certificate based on your replay of the archive session. Again, please bookmark that site, follow up with our speakers if you have additional questions or comments, and I certainly hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. I want to echo the thanks to all of the speakers, organizers, and support staff who helped today, and the over 260 individuals who joined us for today's live delivery. We hope that you'll join us on a future internet seminar. And with that, it's my pleasure to formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.